General Budzinski, arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, is Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is a child sexual assault case in which the defendant, Daryl Budzinski, was convicted of having sexual contact with his then 4 to 6 year old niece. The issue presented on appeal is whether Mr. Budzinski is entitled to a new trial because the trial court answered no when the jury asked whether they had to agree on the room in which the charged assault took place. Mr. Budzinski argued on appeal that the court's answer to that question violated his due process right to have the state prove every element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt and his state constitutional right to a unanimous verdict. The majority of the Court of Appeals agreed with him. The state asked the court to reverse the Court of Appeals. The constitutional requirements of proof beyond a reasonable doubt and jury unanimity apply only to the elements of the offense with which a defendant is charged. In this case, there are only two elements: that the defendant had sexual contact with the victim, and second, that the victim was under the age 13. Those are the only two facts that the state had to prove and the only two facts upon which the jury had to agree unanimously. The disputed trial about whether the assault could have taken place in the laundry room, as the victim had testified, was relevant to the jury's determination of her credibility. But the specific location in the house where the sexual assault took place was not an element of the offense. So the state did not have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, nor did the jury have to agree upon it unanimously.
Counsel, I didn't understand their argument to suggest that it was an element of the offense. In fact, your brief says you are mistaken when you characterize that it that way. Their brief says, page 5, the state misconstrues Budzinski's position. Budzinski is not arguing that the location of the offense charged is, in fact, an element of the crime. Rather, it is his position that the room in which the sexual assault allegedly occurred is a fact necessary to establish the element of the crime. In other words, the first element that a sexual assault occurred.
I'm not sure I understand the distinction between a fact necessary to establish an element and an element. Mm-hmm.
We'll see. I guess I do only in this sense. It seems to me that Judge Fine, in writing his opinion, emphasized that this is a pretty unique fact situation. Both opinions of the Court of Appeals said it is undisputed. There is no evidence that the sexual assault occurred other than in
the laundry room.
Yeah, the laundry room. That's what both opinions said. And so as Judge Fine then unfolds his comments, he goes on to say, essentially, okay, if it didn't happen in the laundry room, based on the evidence in this record, it didn't happen at all.
And I think that's a fundamental flaw in Judge Fine's.
It may be a fundamental flaw, but that's the, you know, it may or may not be, but that's what the argument is, that a fact necessary to prove the element, the first element of sexual assault occurred. On this record, you don't have it.
But it is not a fact necessary to establish. For example,
it's not an element, but in this unique fact case, given the testimony of the parties, that's what their argument is.
But I think it's wrong because, you know, suppose the victim had said, I don't remember what room it happened in. Would you say, would the jury be required to agree? No. Let me give another illustration removed from the facts of this case. Let's say we had an armed robbery case. The victim says, I was walking down the street when I was accosted by a man who was holding a gun in his left hand and said, give me your money. I'm familiar with this guy. I see him in the neighborhood frequently. The defense puts on witnesses who say, the defendant couldn't hold a gun in his left hand. He injured his hand 2 years earlier. He had a disabling injury. And the defense puts on a stream of witnesses that says he couldn't hold it in his left hand. Well, by Mr. Badzinski's theory, the hand in which the gun was being held was a fact necessary to establish an element. And I think for the same reasons it's not an element here, whether or not the person could hold the gun in his left hand went to the credibility of the witness. The same thing is true here. If it were a fact necessary to establish an element, Mr. Badzinski should have asked for a jury instruction at the outset. In fact, it raises the question, if the Court of Appeals were affirmed by this Court, what happens on retrial?
His argument really isn't that in most situations or in – his argument, as I understand it, is that this is a peculiar situation. It's not generally that location has to be proven in order to establish the first element. But given this evidentiary record, as Judge Fine says in paragraph 35, but if the jurors believe Badzinski's niece, the assault did not happen anywhere other than in the basement or laundry room. The trial court, in effect, told the jury to ignore this and let the jurors pick any room or rooms in their house. And he goes on to talk about that the jury can't speculate. It has to be based on the evidence. So.
But the flaw in that, and I think it's the same flaw that Mr. Badzinski makes in his brief. I'll quote from his brief. He says, this is page 6, if the jurors did not believe that the assault occurred in the laundry room, then that jury could not, as a matter of law, believe the victim's testimony that she had been sexually assaulted by Badzinski.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is it is well established that the trier of fact may accept some of a witness testimony and not others. The only facts necessary to establish the sexual contact element was the victim's testimony that he made me put my hand on his penis. That's the fact necessary. There are often key factual disputes in a trial that have nothing to do with an element that the defense may be focused on. It may be the centerpiece of the defense's attack on the witness's credibility, but it only goes to credibility. So I would suggest that there's actually nothing unique about the facts of this case, that there often is a key fact that the defense tries to undermine the victim's testimony on.
If I may, just one point for clarification of your position. And that is, I indicated in my questions that both opinions of the Court of Appeals indicated that there was no dispute. I'm going to read from Judge Brennan's opinion, paragraph 27, on that very point. Paragraph 27, Judge Brennan, in the opinion, states, finally, it is undisputed that there was no evidence of a sexual assault in any other room but the laundry room. Do you agree with that statement?
Not fully. It's certainly, the victim testified it occurred in the laundry room. The defense was, well, it couldn't have happened that way. There were too many people around. They couldn't have gone infected. There certainly was evidence that the victim testified that she was probably playing hide-and-seek when she went into the laundry room. There was evidence that there were other rooms in the house where Mr. Badzinski could have been sitting and masturbating up on the other floors. And there was evidence that the kids would go all around the house. So it's true in a limited sense is that's where the victim testified that she recalled it happening. So there was no dispute in the sense that certainly the state went with the victim's testimony, and the defense strategy was to say, don't believe her. It couldn't have happened that way.
Let's just double back on the instruction.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear it.
Let's double back on the instruction. The court instructed that they had to reach an agreement that the assault occurred in the house, right?
That was in response to a previous action.
Was that correct?
No. It was understandable under the circumstances, but for reasons having nothing to do with this issue.
So the judge gave a wrong answer.
Gave a wrong answer with the consent of both parties, and the error inured to Mr. Bedzinski's benefit.
And you're not arguing that they waived this. They both consented. Okay. The next question was, do they have to agree that it happened in the laundry room, right?
Correct.
And there the judge responded, no. And that's the correct answer, right,
yes,
in your opinion. So we have one incorrect answer and one correct answer. And the question is that together, an incorrect answer about the law plus a correct answer of the law, do they confuse, mislead the jury, or make it reasonably likely that they're going to reach the wrong result? Or words to that effect, right? And this is a credibility case, right? You got the... she's how old when she testifies?
I believe she was 19, perhaps 20.
Okay. And the event occurred when she was how old?
It was between ages of 4 and 6.
Okay, 4 and 6. So roughly 14, 15 years, depending on the time, have elapsed, right?
Right.
And it's her testimony now. There's nothing about her testimony earlier, right?
No, she didn't disclose until... Okay. Shortly before the charges were brought.
So why can't a reasonable juror be misled to think that once they agree it happened in the house unanimously, that her credibility about the room is irrelevant, and that they just don't look at that or need to do that, and in effect, these two instructions took away from the juror one aspect of her credibility?
I don't think it did, and I think it would be in this case when the claim is that a legally correct instruction, which is the only one that's being challenged, is the second, misled, it's the defendant's burden to show a reasonable probability that it misled. But I think you read everything in context. I don't think there's anything, because the defense, there was never an issue at trial that if it happened, it happened in the house. The issue at trial was, could it have happened in this room? That was the whole center point of the defense. So that, I think, in the context of all the evidence, I don't think the jury could have understood, or a reasonable jury would be likely to have understood that answer, no, you don't have to agree upon the room, as saying, forget about that controversy. It's just, it says what it says it is. You don't have to agree.
The jury here returned a verdict of guilty as charged in the information, right?
Correct.
And the jury was instructed that the information charged that on these specific dates, at this specific address in this city and county of Milwaukee, state of Wisconsin, and then it gives the counts.
Right.
So when the jury returned a verdict of guilty, they were determining that at 3666 South 25th Street, this is where the assault occurred, right?
Correct. Now.
And the defense in this case moved to have, previously moved to have further clarification regarding the charges because they didn't think that they were given enough notice as to the specificity of the charges. Isn't that true?
That was true, but that got cleared up prior to trial,
right,
with the agreement of defense counsel.
Was there ever any sort of motion saying, I want to know which room she's going to say, or that's something the jury needs to find, anything like that?
No, and that's why I'm saying if this were a fact essential to the verdict, one would have expected you wouldn't leave it to a jury question. The defense should have been asking for an instruction on that point. The answer had
do you think
answer,
they even had to have
refused the
do you think they even had to have the house address in the charging document?
No, it had to, as long as there's something that establishes venue in Milwaukee County.
Okay, thank you.
But the instructions to the jury say, and I quote, the burden of establishing every fact necessary to constitute guilt is upon the state. And
right.
It's the defense argument that this fact is necessary in this case, given that there's no evidence that it occurred elsewhere.
Two things. The jury instructions then go on to tell exactly what those facts are, namely the elements, that there was a sexual contact and that the victim was under age 13. Those are the essential facts, the facts necessary to a verdict. Everything else goes to credibility.
Mr. Castle, are you making any alternative argument in regard to harmless error?
I have not made any. I have not made any harmless error.
You don't intend to?
I haven't given it a thought, so no, I do not intend to.
Mr. Castle, in reviewing the testimony at the trial, your confidence in the laundry room as the site of a possible sexual assault shaken?
I think the defense put on evidence that, if believed by the jury, could have raised in the minds of a juror a question. Sure, this was my personal confidence. I leave that to the jury. The jury could have believed that, as the victim testified, the other side of the family had, in her words, disowned her. The jury didn't have to believe the defense witnesses. But I guess the answer is it doesn't matter whether my confidence was shaken. It doesn't matter whether this court's confidence is shaken. This court, the question is, did the jury instruction misstate the elements or mislead the jury? And because all the jury had to decide was whether there was sexual contact and the victim's age, that's all that matters. So a jury could easily have believed, this was 14 years ago. She might be remembering incorrectly the location where this happened. But we found her account of finding him sitting on the floor, masturbating, having me come over and touch his penis. We find that credible. That's enough. That's all the jury needed to find. That's all the state needed to prove. That's all the jury needed to be unanimous about.
There were six possible dates for this alleged sexual assault.
I believe that's correct.
What was there? Do we know what time of day the sexual assault was supposed to have occurred?
I don't believe so. There was testimony from both the victim and the family members that these events usually started around noon and lasted into the evening. But I don't believe the victim testified as to what time this happened or how many other people were at the house by that time. There was testimony that the defendant often was a late arriver, but that's about it in the record, as I recall.
Would it be fair to say when did the alleged victim arrive? Was she an early arrival every time, or?
I don't recall her testimony on that point or not. Again, all those issues are credibility issues that the jury ultimately found, and there's not a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence in this court. The jury was certainly entitled to believe her testimony about what happened, even if it didn't believe or was unsure about the room, precise room in which it occurred.
I'm going to try again. We agree that it's a credibility issue, right?
Yes.
And when the judge tells the jury that they don't all have to agree whether the assault took place in the laundry room, isn't the judge telling the jury, in effect, that her truthfulness is not important in the case? The fact that they think she's not telling the truth about where it occurred is not something they should consider. And therefore, the judge is ruling or pushing the jury towards a verdict.
I strongly disagree with that. In fact, I think if the judge had answered yes, it would have told the jury that you can't find that you believe her account of the defendant making her touch him. You can't find that credible unless you also believe that it occurred in the laundry room. So I think the bigger danger of misleading the jury would have been to answer the question yes, because then it would have been telling the jury that in what Mr. Badzinski argues and what the Court of Appeals seems to suggest, that her credibility was an all-or-nothing thing.
But that's what they're doing, in effect, when he instructs that they need unanimity on the house, because there is unanimity in the testimony that if it occurred, it occurred in that house, right?
Right.
And so that's bolstering her credibility. And on the other hand, the saying you don't have to agree that it was in the laundry room, saying, hey, even if she doesn't remember this right, and even if she can't remember it right, it's irrelevant. And so argument is that the judge is taking away credibility from the jury. That's the argument, isn't it?
That's the argument. I disagree. I don't think it's telling the jury anything about how to evaluate credibility. It's telling the jury that its determination on that issue is not determinative of whether it believes her on the elements, the facts.
But it's determinative on the issue of the house. That's what the judge said.
Well, Counselor, doesn't the information list that as the location? And you have to have something to venue it in Milwaukee County or you'll get kicked out on venue, correct?
Right. And the witness testified that it happened at the grandparents' house and it was at such and such address, and that address is in Milwaukee County.
Right, right.
No one objected to the venue here.
No one.
Well, if he'd answered that question otherwise, then you could argue that where's the venue?
Well, the jury doesn't have to answer. I see my. Oh,
You were hoping.
My eye was playing trick on me.
That's all right. You still have time.
No, a jury is not required to give, make a finding on...
Right, on venue.
On venue. But the... Now my light is on. If I may complete my answer.
You may, counsel.
But I think the best way to understand the party's agreement about that it happened in this house was to look at it in the context of the whole notice issue. I think had the judge said no on that question, too, then we would be hearing from the defendant, wait a minute, we had this whole notice issue, we litigated.
So you think it goes to the notice concern?
I think so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Castle. Basil M. Loeb, representing Daryl Budzinski. Counsel.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. My name is Basil Loeb. I represent Daryl J. Budzinski. Mr. Budzinski is in the courtroom this afternoon. He's in the gallery. With all due respect to Judge Brennan, with all due respect to the state, I think the trial court, Judge Simple, basically took the case away from the jury and allowed a man to be convicted based upon pure speculation. This entire trial was about the laundry room in the basement of the victim's grandparents' house. The sole evidence that Mr. Budzinski had committed a crime and had sexual contact with his niece was that it occurred one time on one of six potential dates during either Christmas or Easter, and that it occurred in the laundry room of the basement during one of these family gatherings. That was the sole evidence against Mr. Budzinski.
Well, Mr. Loeb, wouldn't that line of argument be very similar to, say, the child for some reason when she was testifying would have said that her assailant was wearing a red shirt? And everybody in the, for whatever reason, other witnesses were asked about it, and the witnesses said, no, the defendant was wearing a blue shirt that day. Would that all of a sudden, and then the jury had sent out a note, and instead of asking, did this happen in the laundry room, do we all have to agree that he was wearing a blue shirt or a red shirt? Wouldn't your argument be the same?
My argument would definitely be the same with respect to that, yes. But my point here is that the judge, in answering the question the way the judge answered his question, he allowed the jury to speculate to matters beyond
the evidence. Let me ask this. Let's say it's not a child sexual assault, but say an armed robbery, and a clerk at a store is working behind the cash register, and a robber comes in and puts a shotgun in the clerk's face and says, hand over all the cash. Now, same situation. The clerk testifies that it was a blue shirt, and there is no video, but there are other customers or whatever, onlookers standing around, and they all testify, no, it wasn't that color, it was a different color. Would you say that that would be an essential element, that clerk be correct?
I wouldn't say it was an essential element. I would say
it's an essential fact that is necessary to show an essential element.
As long as in that scenario, the only evidence whatsoever presented by the prosecution was that it was a blue shirt. My whole point here is that the sole evidence presented by
where
the prosecution.
Where does it stop? What if the clerk says the assailant, the robber, was wearing glasses, and everybody else says, no, they weren't wearing, that person wasn't wearing, the defendant wasn't wearing glasses that day? Same thing?
I feel the same way, yes. If the sole evidence was that they were.
So the state has to prove the elements that are in the jury instructions that the case law, that are based on the case law and the statutes, but they have to prove what color the shirt was.
Well, not necessarily, but in this case, the state's whole theory of prosecution was that there was a sexual contact that happened in the basement laundry room. I don't think it's the same thing.
I'm confused by your answers to Justice Gableman's question.
I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, I couldn't hear you.
I said, I'm confused by your answers to Justice Gableman's question. Your answers were, if that was the sole evidence. You said that twice in response to his questions.
Right.
But I understood his questions to be, there was evidence that there was a red shirt, and there was an evidence there was a blue shirt. So it wasn't the sole evidence. So I'm confused by that.
I think the point I'm trying to make, and I'll try to answer the question a little bit better, is that the state's theory in this case was that there was sexual contact. It happened in the basement laundry room, and that was the only evidence that would have supported a finding of guilt. The only evidence the state said Pazinski did this is that it happened in the basement laundry room on one occasion only. Clearly, based upon what the jury asked to the judge, not once but twice, they were unsure as to whether a sexual contact occurred in the laundry room. My opinion, and obviously the opinion that's shared by two members of the Court of Appeals, is that because the only evidence introduced at trial was that the sexual contact happened in the laundry room, the act of it occurring in the laundry room was a fact essential to a finding of guilt, and because the trial court answered the way they did, they basically relieved the jury of making any type of decision with respect to whether they thought unanimously that the sexual contact happened in the laundry.
What about the testimony that she thought it occurred while she was playing hide-and-seek and that the children played hide-and-seek in many rooms of the house?
Well, there was no other evidence or testimony that would have corroborated that statement from the victim. In my opinion, my reading of the testimony from the trial was that she was adamant that it did occur in the laundry room basement. And Pazinski presented his whole defense by lining up 11 witnesses that would have stated that it didn't happen,
well,
and it couldn't have happened.
I understand that, but there still was testimony that she said it occurred while she was playing hide-and-seek, and there was testimony by others that the children played hide-and-seek throughout the house. So if the jury were to line up those two facts together, then they may think, well, maybe she was wrong about the room, but not wrong about the assault. How do you answer that?
Well, again, I don't think the jury shouldn't be able to pick and choose what they believe from the victim, and they certainly shouldn't be in a position where they can speculate into matters that are outside of evidence. The victim didn't say the sexual contact occurred anywhere else other than in that basement laundry room.
But you're focusing on that part of the victim's testimony, but we have lots of cases that say a jury doesn't have to take on whole cloth everything a witness said. The jury can pick and choose what part of the testimony they believe to be credible. So if the jury heard that the children played hide-and-seek in many parts of the house, they heard not a little girl when she testified, but the young woman say the assault occurred during hide-and-seek, why couldn't they think, well, she was mistaken, she was hiding in the laundry room. Maybe she was hiding in the bathroom next door when the sexual assault occurred, was still part of hide-and-seek.
Well, I would have considered that to be an unreasonable jury verdict then, and I would say that a rational jury would not have reached that type of a conclusion based upon the facts submitted under that scenario.
Okay.
Tell me what you think of the engaging in repeated acts of sexual assault of the same child statute.
Can you repeat the question, please?
The 948.025, whoever commits three or more violations under 948.02 within a specified period of time involving the same child is guilty, and then it goes down of various felonies. And then if it's tried to a jury in order to find the defendant guilty, the jury must unanimously agree that at least three violations occurred within a specified period of time, but need not agree on which acts constitute the requisite number. I mean, if you think this statute's bad, you really have to think that statute's bad.
Yeah, and I don't think it matters here because, again, the testimony and the undisputed facts is that it was just a singular occurrence. And that's, I think, absolutely
that's
clear.
Under that one, they don't even have to agree on the same three sexual assaults.
Right, but again, that's not relevant here. I don't find that relevant here. I don't think anybody can realistically argue that it wasn't undisputed, that it was one fact and that it occurred in the basement laundry room.
I'm having a hard time getting by. I need you to explain to me when a jury has to be unanimous and when they don't, because it sounds to me like you are saying they have to be unanimous as to the facts of the case.
They have to be unanimous as to the facts of a conduct that a person did that is illegal. And in my opinion, in this situation here, they had to unanimously agree that Mr. Bedzinski had one act of sexual contact with his niece in the basement laundry room. And in my opinion,
but where do you get the in the basement laundry room? I understand those happen to be the facts of this particular case, but it could have been. I've had a lot of sexual assault cases, unfortunately, and often a victim doesn't really remember. They don't remember the date. They just know it was within this general time frame, somewhere around Easter, somewhere in the house. This is kind of how it went down. I remember how it happened. You're convicted on a regular basis of that. And I'm just trying to figure out if all of those cases should be reversed, because there's no way I would ever know if the jury decided that there was one group of facts that supported the conviction, especially in these multiple sexual assaults of a child, when the allegation is within this three-year period, three or more sexual assaults occurred, and then they testified to 10 sexual assaults. The jury doesn't have to agree on which three they think happened, when, where, what dates, or any of that. Well, so is this all wrong? It's all just been done wrong for all these years?
I wouldn't say that. I would say the victim in this case was very specific in not only what she was alleging, but in my opinion, when it happened, because she specifically said Christmas Day.
Let me ask you this. If this victim, instead of saying what she said, said, yeah, I just remember it happening, and I remember it being, you know, in the house. I can't remember which house it was. They moved three times, but they always lived in Milwaukee. Does that mean the state can't charge that?
No, and I wouldn't be making the arguments I'm making today if that was the scenario. And if the victim at trial had said, I think it occurred in the basement laundry room, but I'm not sure, then I would feel differently as well. But she was adamant that that's where it occurred. And again,
the lesson to the state is don't ever allege where it happened.
Well, I think when it's a 14-year difference between when it happened and when it's charged, you know, the state's looking to be as specific as possible to bolster the credibility of their witness. So I think that, you know, that's a little bit different situation. But if the victim in this case had said, I think it occurred in the basement laundry room. I think it was while I was playing hide and seek. This is what my uncle was doing. I would feel a little bit differently than when I read the transcripts and it indicates that it definitely happened in the basement laundry room and it only happened once and it happened on one of six specific holidays. I feel differently because of that. Again, as Justice Bradley said at the beginning of the state's argument, it's a very unique fact situation here. This case is not like anything else that I've seen.
If we are giving trial court judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers the one rule of law to come out of this case, I think it'd be a really different one. So what is it? What is it? When does the jury have to be unanimous on the facts that support the elements, and when doesn't the jury have to?
Well, if it's a situation where the state has a singular theory of prosecution that a specific act occurred in a specific place, and the jury obviously is struggling with whether they believe the victim or not, and go to the judge and say, you know, do we have to agree where this specifically occurred, I think...
I can tell you that's almost always the case. It's almost always one person's word against the other person's word. They're figuring out who they believe. That's almost always the way it goes down. So,
well, I agree with that.
When do you have to be unanimous about which person's version of the facts you accept is more appealing to?
There's only one version that's presented by the prosecution, which is what happened here. The only version presented by the prosecution was that there was one act of sexual contact in that basement laundry room, and that's it. They have to agree unanimously on that, in my opinion.
Why are you stopping, though, with the room? Why don't you require, I mean, typically we don't even require them to say exactly what sexual assault occurred.
I'm not necessarily stopping at the room. I'm saying in this particular unique set of facts, it should be that it occurred in that basement laundry room because that's what the victim said, and that was the only evidence that would support a finding of guilt.
So would they have to agree as to whether it was, you know, what kind of touching it might have been or what kind of intercourse it might have been or what exactly was used to assault the person?
No, I don't believe so.
So you'd require the room, but the jury doesn't have to agree as to what happened with the sexual assault?
Well, as long as it meets the definition of what the statute would be.
One person could think it's touching, the other person could think they did something else?
Yes.
And that doesn't matter. There doesn't have to be unanimity with that, but you better know what room it happened in.
Right. And I would agree that that line would be consistent with State versus Lamegro, where there was six different potential sexual acts presented as a theory of prosecution, and it was a one-count information, and the jury did not have to be unanimous as to which of the six acts supported the finding of guilt. So I would agree with that. This is a unique factual situation where it was obvious the jury was struggling with whether they believed the victim or not and whether it happened in this laundry room or not, and they didn't get the chance to, you know, just decide that issue. And instead, they were allowed to speculate, and instead they were allowed to come back with a guilty verdict that was based upon, in my opinion, pure speculation that a sexual contact occurred outside the basement laundry room.
Does the instruction that they had to agree on the house help you, or is it irrelevant?
I don't think it's totally irrelevant, but I think...
Pardon me?
I don't think it's totally irrelevant. I think it goes to, and I know, you know, a lot of people have been saying you can't speculate what a jury's thinking, and Judge Brennan went into that in her her opinion, but there's got to be some speculation as to why the jury is asking these questions during their deliberations. And clearly they were struggling with that component of the case with respect to, you know, the location. So it goes, in my opinion, to show how much the jury was struggling with this case and how important the issue of where the specific act occurred is to this case.
How long was the jury out in deliberations?
It was over three separate days, I believe, you know, for at least, I would say, 4 to 6 hours. I can't recall specifically.
The you don't find too many cases where, but you find some, where the victim is very young, and you do have a body of cases, especially in the clergy area. Victim is young. It takes the victim 10, 15, 20, 25 years to come forward. You don't have a statute of limitations problem here, do we?
No.
It takes them, and then there's a prosecution. And that's what happened here. Is there anything in the record, and I don't want you to tell me anything out of the record, anything in the record that explains why a prosecutor would bring this case this amount of time after it happened? Was there anything in the record in, at sentencing that indicated this defendant had other charges on sexual assault with a child or anyone else?
No, I don't want
anything outside the record. I just want in the record.
No, there was not.
Nothing to say why the prosecutor exercised his discretion here to go forward.
No, my assumption would be that the prosecutor believed the victim and felt they could prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very close dispute. It was obviously a very contentious case based upon, you know, the testimony, based upon those questions from the jury and how long they deliberated for.
And how many witnesses were there for the prosecution and for the defense? And generally, what was the prosecution's witnesses and what were the defense witnesses?
The defense presented, I believe, 11 people. They were all family members that would have been present at these family gatherings.
And members of the husband or the wife of the victim, both sides. Okay.
And then I know the victim testified, the victim's mother, and then a couple law enforcement personnel regarding when the victim reported the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Counsel, please.
Mr. Loeb, the Chief Justice often asks a question of how you would rate the opinion. The court looks at an opinion like this, of course, as something that applies to more than this specific case. It's the controlling law of the state. I'm having a little trouble understanding what the principle of law is that you seek to invoke here, and that would be the precedent we set in an opinion.
I'd have a couple of, responses to that. One would be that, and I don't think this is about the elements, and I don't think I'm asking for the court to come up with a ruling that would indicate that the specific room is required as an element in a sexual assault case. My argument would be that the trial court should not be in a position where they allow a jury to speculate, they allow a jury to consider matters outside of the evidence and to come up with what the jury thinks may have happened to support a guilty finding. That's a difficult question to ask because this is such a unique fact situation. And I'm not the one that petitioned for reviewing this case, obviously, either. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's about the elements. I think it's about not allowing a jury to base its verdict on pure speculation. And I go back to what Judge Fine wrote and what I wrote in my brief. My opinion here is that the verdict was based upon pure speculation. The jury speculated that there was sexual contact that occurred outside the laundry room, even though there was no evidence in the record.
So is this a sufficiency of the evidence case?
No. I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that Mr. Bedzinski was denied his right to a unanimous verdict and that the conviction was based upon pure speculation by the jury, which was allowed by the trial court in the trial court's answer to the jury question.
Ironic that an observation about speculation would be based upon speculation, isn't it?
And I agree. And there's where I think it's helpful that there's not one but two jury questions with respect to the location, and they were obviously struggling with that issue. And there has to be some speculation as to why they asked those questions. They didn't just ask those questions arbitrarily. And that does play a role in the analysis.
You've never been surprised by a jury verdict or a jury question?
I have always been surprised.
Then our experiences have been similar.
Counsel, in response to a question asked by Justice Ziegler, you said this was not a sufficiency of evidence case. In response to a question asked by Justice Rogensack, however, you responded using the sufficiency of evidence standard. That is, you employed the standard of would any rational trier of fact have decided. Those are the words you used, and those are the buzzwords for the standard of sufficiency of evidence. I see this case perhaps incorrectly, so I want you to tell me why I'm wrong, as at its essence a sufficiency of evidence case. That you are arguing, you said, that in response to Justice Cross's question, you would say the jury cannot consider matters outside the evidence of the case. Another way of saying it is there's not sufficient evidence in this case. You said you would write the opinion saying jurors are not to speculate. Well, another way of saying not to speculate is there's not evidence in this case, so they're going to have to speculate. So when I hear your answers, and quite frankly, when I read Judge Fine's opinion, it was on inadequate evidence. Not enough evidence to sustain. Well, he didn't say it that way. He said the jury can't speculate. There's no evidence in this record. You can't go outside the record. Those are also euphemisms for insufficiency of evidence. So tell me why you think this is not an insufficiency of evidence case. What am I seeing incorrect?
Well, I think it's because of the trial court's answer to the jury question. I think if the trial court had said, yes, you need to agree on the room in which the sexual contact occurred, and the jury came back with a I lost my train of thought with respect to that. I'm struggling a little bit with that.
Let me rephrase it to help you plug back in. As I understand it, you're saying in large part that there's not sufficient, the way I see it, I want you to correct me, there isn't sufficient evidence to support a jury determination of guilt. That's what you're saying. that in this case they would have to speculate based on the evidence that was presented, the sole evidence that was presented, that they would have to decide on things outside the record, that there's not sufficient evidence to support a jury determination of guilt. That's what I hear you saying, but I might be hearing incorrectly. So that's what, now, are you able to hit that ball that I just pitched to you?
There's no evidence to support a guilty finding, in my opinion, that a sexual contact happened outside the laundry room. My argument is that, based upon how the trial court answered the question, he allowed the jurors to speculate. He, in my opinion, confused and misled the jurors and allowed them to essentially pick and choose wherever in the house they believed a sexual contact occurred, even though the victim's testimony did not support that type of a finding. So, and I think that's what Judge Fine was getting to in his opinion as well. So I don't necessarily think it's a sufficiency of evidence issue. It's allowing the jury, it's confusing the jury, it's misleading the jury, it's allowing the jury to come up with
a decision really not based on the evidence of this case.
Or an alternate theory of prosecution. Right.
Okay.
The state's saying there's a sexual contact that happened, and my light just went on, in the laundry room. The judge is basically telling the jury, forget about what you've heard throughout this whole trial, forget about what the state's theory of prosecution is. If you think it happens in some other room, even though there's no evidence to support that, then go find him guilty. That's what I'm saying.
The reason I think you're getting questions on sufficiency of evidence is because if the case said no sufficient evidence, there would be no retrial. You're asking for a retrial, aren't you?
Yes.
And you're asking for a retrial not because there isn't sufficient evidence, it's because the jury has been misled in dealing with the evidence by an instruction that was an erroneous one.
Right.
Is that a good summation of your argument?
Couldn't have said it better myself, yes. And I think that it's a situation, like I said earlier, the judge simple let the jury off the hook, and they didn't have to come to what, in my opinion, would have been a very difficult.
When you say off the hook, you mean as to credibility.
Right. Is there any other questions that I can answer?
So far, no. Thank you very much,
very
counsel.
Much. Well,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I do
Justice
have a question.
Justice Prosser.
Did the defense witnesses describe what a Christmas day was like for all of those 3 years, or an Easter day was like all of those 3 years? I mean, I got from opposing counsel that there could have been a time period of 6-7 hours in which the alleged sexual assault could have occurred. Is that would you agree with that, or would you disagree?
I would agree with that, and there was a lot of testimony regarding what the adults did and what the kids did, and where it was cloudy was the particular times that the victim would have been there and the defendant would have been there at the same time. So I agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Castle.
I'd like to touch on this sufficiency of the evidence question just very briefly, because Mr. Loeb says correctly that he has not framed this as a sufficiency of the evidence. A sufficiency of the evidence challenge would not succeed. A jury cannot base its verdict on speculation, but here the jury was basing its verdict on the testimony of the victim about the defendant placing her hand on his penis and on the testimony that she was about 4 to 6 years old at the time. There's no speculation. The jury is not required to make any speculation. The jury may have been unsure about the room it occurred in. The jury may have believed it did, but it probably didn't occur in that room. It doesn't matter. And that brings me to my second point. The defendant has talked about kind of the uniqueness of the facts of this case. But I think, as Justice Gableman's questioning points out, the particular location may be unique to this, but there's nothing unusual about there being some specific part.
Let's take the red shirt, blue shirt, okay?
Yes.
So suppose that you've got mixed testimony about red shirt, blue shirt, and the judge says to the jury on questions, you don't have to decide unanimously whether it's red or blue, but you have to decide unanimously that he was wearing a shirt. That's like this case.
Well, that's not really red shirt, blue shirt.
I disagree. That would not be like this.
No shirt.
Because I think, you know, and I assume you're, but you have to decide that it's, he was wearing a shirt, you're referring to.
Now this is my hypothetical, mind you, just to help the Chief Justice to bolster your memory. This is the hypothetical where the robber is pointing the shotgun at the clerk's face. So go ahead.
I recall that. I'm asking the Chief Justice, if I understand her question, that you added the twist of, but you have to agree that he was wearing a shirt, analogous to the first answer.
Yes, I'm trying to make it analogous to this case. Ordinarily, whether the guy was wearing a red shirt or blue shirt is not an element. It goes to credibility. It goes to identification. But what you added in is, right, but he's got, you got to be unanimous that he's wearing a shirt and that he's not shirtless, right?
Like this case.
You got to find him in the house.
And that would have been an erroneous instruction, but not one that prejudiced the defendant.
Just like this case. You don't think that the fact that he said, that the judge said, you got to find that he unanimously was in the house, that's an erroneous instruction, but it didn't prejudice, right?
Right.
Same thing about the shirt.
It has never been challenged.
It's not an element. That's your whole argument.
That's my whole argument. And that there, in any case, there could be any fact that is critical to a victim's testimony, that his or her version of events is the subject of an attack by the defense saying it couldn't have happened this way because of X, Y, or Z. And that doesn't mean that the state has to prove that non-element.
Well, now you're touching upon, I believe, Justice Ziegler's observation that in these kinds of cases, there will always be conflicts over the factual situations.
That's exactly my point. That's why I'm saying Mr. Bezinski has argued under the unique facts of this case, and I'm saying there's nothing unique about the facts of this case.
Only thing unique is the wrong instruction.
Excuse me?
The only thing unique is the wrong instruction.
The first instruction.
The instruction that they had to be unanimous on the house. And that is what the issue in the case is, whether that creates a pallor on the jury's determination of credibility. You say it doesn't. I understand.
I say it does not.
But that is unique. It's not often that the judge will give an instruction about a fact that isn't an element.
Right.
We hope it's not unique.
Correct.
And but we hope it is unique, I guess.
And I see my time is up, and I thank you.
Are there floor plans of this house in the record?
My recollection is that there was evidence introduced about whether hand-drawn, that, yes, there is evidence of a sketch of the basement layout.
About other floors?
There's testimony about where the, I don't know that there was a layout of, if my recollection is this was a one-story house with a finished basement. And so that the most of the events when the family was together, the weather didn't permit them to be outside on the deck. They were in the basement rec room. So there was a sketch of the basement, but I don't believe there was any sketch of the mansion. Thank you, Mr. Castle.
I want to thank Mr. Castle and Mr. Loeb for their arguments today. The concept of when a jury has to be unanimous and when it doesn't, and what's the effect of an instruction that's erroneous as a matter of law and an instruction that is misleading, these are issues that have come to the court before and probably will in the future, and we appreciate your arguments and briefs in a different application of those legal issues. That concludes our hearing in 11AP2905CR, State versus Budzinski. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when it will hear another three cases in oral argument. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:05 today. We are...